Regular listeners to this podcast will notice a thematic semblance that connects this week's conversation to the one from last week. Then I spoke with the scholars Neil Rogachevsky and Dov Ziegler about their outstanding new book on Israel's Declaration of Independence. In the course of that conversation, we discussed how, as a matter of scholarship, their study of Israel's founding document is consistent with a style and a manner of the study of America's founding documents that was pioneered by thinkers like Martin Diamond, Herbert Storing, and Walter Burns. Well, these political scientists probed America's Declaration of Independence and the debate over the ratification of the Constitution and subsequent debates over the Bill of Rights and further amendments. They treated these arguments in their historical and legal context, and they also studied how these texts relate to the Western tradition of thinking about power and justice and citizenship and freedom and equality. But they also probed those texts in search of a deeper classical insight that the law is, among other things, a moral teacher. And the highest law, the constitutional structures that constrain normal laws, this higher law manifests foundational moral commitments that anchor a regime. Now, these scholars sought in the American constitutional tradition not merely an understanding of how the Philadelphia delegates came to compromise in Article 1 of the Constitution. They sought instead to derive from that political settlement an understanding of the elemental concepts of equality and representation that would form the matrix of the American order. That is the spirit of today's conversation, too. We'll look explicitly at the American Constitution in search of its elemental concepts, and focus in particular on the ones that might be useful for Israelis at this hour of political instability. Welcome to the Tikva podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Silver. My guest is the author Yuval Levin, who is also the editor of National Affairs and the Beth and Ravenel Curry Chair in Public Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. On April 1st, Levin published an op-ed in the New York Times called "The Solution to Israel's Crisis Might Be in America's Constitution." That fascinating piece forms the point of departure for our discussion. Now, I'd like, before we begin, to offer one caution up front. I want to say quite explicitly what Yuval Levin's argument is not, and what the implication of this conversation is not. It is not an argument that Israel should simply adopt the American Constitution, or any particular feature of the American Constitution, or that there's any obvious advantage to Israel that would come from importing this foundation stone of the American tradition into its own very different political order. That is why I'm so insistent on noting those scholars who looked underneath the particular features of American constitutionalism and sought the deeper political insights that animated them. In fact, let's take a step further. Let's stipulate that the American Constitution does not suit Israel as a sovereign nation with its own history and its own destiny. And with that having been stipulated, now let's ask the further question. What can the women and men now called upon to establish judicious political structures in Israel learn from the very different American context? That is Yuval Levin's question, and it's ours for today's conversation. If you enjoy this conversation, you can subscribe to the Tikva podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I hope you'll leave us a 5-star review to help us grow this community of ideas. I welcome your feedback on this or any of our other podcast episodes at podcast@tikvafund.org. And of course, if you want to learn more about our work at Tikva, you can visit our website, tikvafund.org, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Here now is my conversation with Yuval Levin. Yuval Levin, welcome back to the Tikva podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
We're going to speak about the American constitutional tradition and the political and civic resources it might offer up to an Israel which is struggling itself to figure out the modes and orders of its self-government. And I suppose the question to begin with is a political question, Yuval, because so much of American politics now you could describe as a reckoning with an earlier moment in which the Americans tried to offer up its constitutional tradition to another country in the Middle East. And I'm thinking about Iraq and the global war on terror and the idea that we could try to form and fashion institutions a little bit like our own there in that country. And that didn't work as anybody intended. And what makes us think that our constitutional tradition has something to offer up to Israel?
Well, I think it's a good question, but also that there are some very significant differences between that situation and this one. Because what we're talking about here, when we think about whether there are some lessons in the American tradition that might be useful to Israelis facing a moment of constitution building, or at least a moment of question about their own system, what we're looking at is a society that is already a democracy, that has been for 75 years, that has developed a very robust democratic culture, and has come to a point in the life of that culture when it confronts basic questions about some of the insufficiencies, the inadequacies of its institutions. And Americans stand as outsiders offering some advice about how the kinds of questions Israel now faces might be answered. I think the United States is in a good place to do that. It is the oldest democracy in the world. We don't think of ourselves as an old country, but we've had the same system of government since 1788, and no one really comes close to that among the democracies. And the system we have arose to solve some of the same kinds of problems that Israel faces now. And so this is offered only as advice. It's offered as advice to a people who have already shown that they not only want democracy, but are very capable of it. And so in that sense, I think it's different from whatever lesson we might draw from the Iraq situation, where obviously, as you say, things did not go as desired, although Iraq is the closest thing to a democracy in the Arab world by far. I think Israel's in a very different situation, and therefore people offering help and advice from the United States are in a very different situation than the U.S. was to Iraq.
So it's important for our listeners to hear that this is not an exercise in some kind of constitutional imperialism, where the Americans are looking down and condescending on Israel, saying, look, this is what we have, this is what we do, and therefore it's what you should do too. The spirit in which this advice is offered up, it starts in a different place and is oriented toward a different purpose.
That's right. And you know, the American system was begun by people who looked for that kind of advice in prior examples of Republican government, too. James Madison, in preparation for the Constitutional Convention, spent a lot of time reading about the Italian republics, the Roman Republic, anything he could get his hand on. There wasn't an example of a modern, successful democratic republic to look at. Israel now does have examples. It certainly has one in the United States. It has one in the European experience, too. And I think it would be wise to look to those examples and foolish not to.
Okay, so I think we should come back to the American Constitution, the debates over its ratification, the problems that it was meant to solve in due course. But what I would like to do now is ask you to dimension for us how you understand Israel's constitutional challenge at this moment.
Well, it's a very complicated question. I mean, the Israeli system of government, on the one hand, has managed to enable the country to thrive, not only to survive, but to flourish through extreme difficulties for a very long time now, for three generations and more. It has great strengths. But I would say that looking at Israel from the outside, you would have to say that it gets by on the basis of an extraordinary amount of public-spiritedness and solidarity among its people that makes up for some very weak institutional structures, and that the Israeli system does not exhibit intentional institutional design. There's less of it really than you would find in any modern democracy. Israel just takes the concept of democracy and dumps it into a unicameral legislature, and that's it. There is just the Knesset. It has all the power. There are no competing power centers that are democratically legitimate. Local governments have no power. The executive is not separate from the legislature. The courts have responded to this over time in Israel, over now more than 40 years, by asserting for themselves some powers of judicial review and judicial nullification, saying some laws violate rights. Sometimes this makes sense, but it has no foundation in Israel's laws. And that means that the judicial power is unmoored from law, which is very dangerous. And so Israel confronts a very basic democratic challenge, which is that its democratic institutions are too concentrated and its counter-majoritarian institutions are essentially ungrounded in law. And that just has to be addressed. Israel can't just continue to assume that it will always have the civic spirit and solidarity to get through the challenges that this kind of system creates. And we can see that it doesn't. We have seen over the last, in some ways really 15 years, but especially the last few years, that this set of institutions, the democratic and the counter-majoritarian, have broken down along the lines that divide Israel's political system, so that the Knesset now largely falls into the hands of the right. The judicial system is very much in the hands of the left, and the conflict between them is the partisan conflict. That is an extremely dangerous situation. And there are very few institutions in Israeli life that are exempt from this division. Really, the only one is the military, which is not what you want. You know, a society where struggles over power can only be resolved by the depth of public respect for the military, well, that's how democracies end. That's not how democracies function. So I think Israel would be very wise to respond to the crisis it's going through now, which in a lot of ways is about this tension between the Knesset and the courts. Not in every way. It's not only, the only thing it's about. But it would be wise to interpret this crisis as being about that and to use it as an impetus for some constitution making, some building of frameworks that allow these kinds of democratic tensions to be resolved in an organized way. I think Israel is very capable of that, and that it's time to do it, that it's time for its democracy to mature.
There's a sort of political mystery that's at work here. The political mystery is that the very conditions that have allowed Israeli society to endure and Israeli politics to function in some manner or other, its civic spirit, the feeling of solidarity, those things emerge out of the very conditions that prevented constitutionalism from taking root in the first place. And that, I would say, is necessarily high attention that's given over to national security, the perception of external threats, the military challenges that Israel's faced for these past 75 years, have been both the reason that it could endure without a constitution and the reason that a constitutional convention was never fully operationalized and a constitution was never written or ratified. In a way, Yuval, I don't know if you agree with this, but one could sort of argue that the very success of Israel's national security apparatus, its phenomenally powerful and successful military, has in fact succeeded in creating the conditions for civic breakdown. It has made the state more secure, not entirely so, but dramatically more secure, and that has sort of unearthed some of the deeper problems that had been pushed to the margins in the past.
I think that's very true. Israel, until relatively recently, just didn't have time to worry about normal problems. It was worried about doing impossible things, about surviving in the Middle East, about integrating massive numbers of immigrants, of Jews coming from around the world, of building itself up from a very poor nation toward quite a wealthy nation. And the sorts of pressures it confronted created the intense solidarity and sense of civic purpose that Israel is so remarkable for, and meant that you could say, look, we can worry about constitutions another day. Right now, we really have to do this. And in the 21st century, Israel is a flourishing modern society. It's not that new anymore. It's not one of the newer nations in the world. It can turn its attention to some enduring political questions, which have been put aside for too long. In a sense, the crisis it's having now is a luxury. The fact that it can trouble itself with these kinds of questions is a luxury, but it's also very dangerous. And I think that if you have to choose between intense civic solidarity or strong institutions, I wouldn't say it's an easy choice, but I think that you would choose strong institutions. The United States, in some ways, from the very beginning, recognized that it would be a divided society, that it was vast. Already at the time of independence, it was larger than any of the European nations, that it was very diverse, and that it needed strong institutions and could not just rely on civic spirit. I think Israel has been able to rely on it and has been right to rely on it and focus on its core survival challenges, but that the time has come now to build a durable political infrastructure. And it has experience to draw on. It knows what its challenges are. It knows what its strengths are. It knows what the key factions in society are. So this is very doable. It's just not easy.
I want to make one final observation, and then we should step into some of the mechanisms of the American constitutional order. But this observation is a reaction to something you just said, Yuval, which is that Israel is a divided and society that is full of its own factions. And, you know, one can conceptualize those factions along different axes. Religious and non-religious, left and right. There are the Haredim and the Arabs, and there's different sectors of Jewish Israelis. I think that the fact that those factions exist and seem to be enduring has frightened some people from entering into this process. They say, there's so little civic trust now. Indeed, the very civic trust that one would need to turn a constitutional crisis such as the one we have into a constitutional opportunity such as the one we wish for, that very civic trust is absent. So this is not the moment to enter into high-minded constitutional thinking. But what I think you've just suggested is that precisely because the Americans presumed that those kinds of divisions in our society would endure and would be ineradicable, and one would not want to fully eradicate them. That the American tradition offers something for the Israelis to consider.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, that ultimately the kind of constitutional order that a free society has is not a function of pre-existing consensus and unity. It is a way of contending with the fact of diversity and division. And the American Constitution very much was built on that premise. It was built on the understanding that if not for it, the country would not hold together. And I think that's true, that it would not have held together. So that at the center of the American constitutional conception, there is an idea of unity, where unity means not thinking alike, but acting together. And the question confronted by the framers of the American Constitution was, given that we don't think alike, how can we act together? Everything about the American Constitution is an answer to that question. And I think there is something for Israel to learn in that, because Israelis aren't going to think alike. No society does, and Israel is divided in some very profound ways that would make it very difficult for that to ever happen. But Israelis can act together. They've shown that for 75 years, again and again. And the idea that a system of government could begin from the premise that it is common action that makes for political unity, and therefore you need institutions that encourage common action across lines of difference, I think would be a very constructive place for Israel to go from the crisis it's found itself in.
So now, thinking as if Yuval Levin were brought in to advise members of Israel's Constitutional Convention, thinking about addressing that audience, maybe it's now time to turn to some of the specific political and civic problems that the American Constitution was erected to solve or address. So why don't you bring us back to that time and help us think through some of that history?
I'd say a few things to start. I think that it's important to grasp that the American Constitution begins in a recognition of the failure of the prior form of government. We don't think very often about that prior form of government. It existed in the United States from the beginning, really, of the Revolutionary War, from the Declaration of Independence, until 1787. So it lasted for about 10 years. It was a system under a kind of constitution called the Articles of Confederation, which created a confederacy. The states were largely independent, and there was a national government to handle defense and trade and a few other things. It was not very effective. It had very little leverage over the states. There was no executive. There was no judiciary. There was a Congress that functioned as a kind of United Nations for the states. And there was broad shared recognition that this was not working, that the states were not going to hold together the system they were living under, and that the likely outcome was breakdown, either into a few collections of states, the northern, central, and southern states, or just into 13 independent nations, and that this would be a disaster. So that the Constitution was framed to begin with to enable national unity, to enable the country to hold together. And in doing that, it sought to overcome a couple of key divisions, regional divisions, where the interests of the North and the South were very different. This, of course, remained the case for a very long time. In some ways, it still is the case. There were also divisions between large states and small ones. You know, the large states like Virginia and New York wanted to have a larger share in the running of the new government. The smaller states thought all states should be equal. I think part of the insight of the framers of the Constitution was that some of these divisions were not bridgeable and therefore had to just be imported wholesale into the new system. So that the Constitution did not decide between the North and the South. It did not decide between the big states and the small states. It created a framework for them to continue to struggle with each other peacefully. And so created a framework where some would have power in this institution and others in that. There would be a constant ongoing tug of war between the key factions of the society. It was not simple democracy. It was not simply majoritarian. The House of Representatives is directly elected, and that was it to begin with. Even the Senate was not. The president is indirectly elected. The courts are appointed. And the idea is you'd have different centers of power, all of which had some claim on authority, none of which was the final arbiter. And so questions would remain open, and politics would consist of a constant kind of pushing and pulling that would compel these different factions into making accommodations with each other, reaching compromises to address problems that needed to be resolved. And I would say that that logic is what could be exported. I don't think that the specific institutions need to be. Obviously, the challenges the factions Israel has are not the same as those the United States had. and the specific institutions may or may not make sense to Israelis. But the idea that the purpose of the system is to create durable arenas of contention for the different interests in society to push and pull, no victory is ever final, no defeat is ever final. The whole purpose is to allow for constant bargaining, negotiation, competition. That, I think, is the logic of a functional democratic republic. And if Israelis think about new institutions, they have to put that thought at the center.
In other words, the very stability of the regime is not because it has quieted difference, but because it has, in a way, elevated difference and relies on the counterpoise of those differences to keep things going.
Yeah, it assumes there will always be these differences, but also that the work of addressing them is unifying work. It gives people a sense that they are engaged in one national purpose. And in that sense, it does build unity, even though it never actually ends the divisions that define society.
Okay, I want to zero in on one particular function of a healthy society that the American framers thought about carefully, that was built into protections in our Bill of Rights and our First Amendment, and that is just central to the Israeli experience, which is religion. Of course, not all Israelis share a religion, just as not all Americans shared a religion then or now. However, the approach to religion in Israel and America is very different. Israel is the Jewish state. It is designed to be the home of the Jewish people, and it has a destiny in our religious imagination that is just simply very different from the American aspirations. The way that our constitutional order treats religion and the way that Israel might think about that would seem to be different.
I agree. I do think it's worth seeing that the way the American system has done this has changed over time also. Most of the states had official religions at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, so that the challenge at the federal level was not to interfere and not to, again, not to resolve in some final way some of the contradictions and disagreements among those. Some of the states did not have an official religion. And the way in which the First Amendment was crafted by the first Congress basically keeps the federal government out of that question. Over time, it kind of has evolved into suggesting that government in general should have no role in religion. None of the states, of course, now have official religions. And the way the Supreme Court now thinks about the First Amendment, they couldn't. It has taken time for that to be the way we think about this. I would say the American tradition of religious freedom draws on two separate threads, one of which is the English tradition of toleration, which arose in a society that did have and does have an official religion. And another is a more Native American tradition of non-establishment, which arose here in a society that has much greater religious diversity, or really it was just inter-Christian diversity, but that was divisive enough. Israel comes at this from a very different vantage point. But I would say that Israel has much more of its own experience to draw on than the United States did when framing the First Amendment. Israel has lived with this question for some time and has created some informal and even some formal institutions around this question that do allow for very significant religious toleration. Israel is a Jewish state with a large Muslim and a fairly large Christian community, and it allows those communities to live in freedom and to control their own lives, not just their own religious lives, but in a lot of ways, their own communities. And I think there is a lesson there and a model there to draw from. It's frankly, in some ways, a kind of Ottoman model, and that's okay. There's a long tradition there too. I think it would need to be formalized in some way if Israel were to constitutionalize its system of government. I would not suggest that they follow the American model on that front. They live in a very, very different situation, and they are a Jewish state with a certain kind of responsibility to take that seriously and to enable it to be part of their governing mechanisms. Israel is in a lot of ways a more Jewish state now than it was at its founding. And so I think that that's a place where it has to think about what models have evolved there that are working, that might be formalized, but to do that in a way that leaves some room, that doesn't resolve every question, that allows for that evolution to continue within a constitutional framework, I do think is very important, because Israel has moved on this question, even in my lifetime, even in the last few years in some ways. And so there's every reason to expect that it will continue to want to think and adjust how it approaches it.
In a way, the kind of analogy that makes the most sense when thinking about the Israeli government's treatment of religion and the way that religion plays an official role in its life is more the analogy of establishment, or at least as much the analogy of establishment as it is toleration. Certainly within Jewish Israel, the quasi-official delegation of real state authority to the rabbinate is one of the enduring questions that is just below the surface of the protest, it seems to me. And the growing Haredi sector is one of the things that most worries some of the protesters, and is an opportunity, I think, from within that sector to begin to wrestle with very complicated and interesting questions of the role that it will have to play in the civic future of the Jewish state. In any event, though one would want for Israel to draw more on its own experience in coming to some kind of enduring settlement, is there anything that they can learn from the American experience of establishment? The reason I ask, Yuval, is because the American experience didn't just stop in the 1790s or something like that. And in fact, when one thinks about establishment questions today, this is going to get a little complicated, but it's worth thinking about, I think. When one thinks about establishment questions today, that is precisely the grounds in which religious conservatives are most concerned about the direction that First Amendment jurisprudence has taken. And that's because, although the language of establishment was first promulgated in order to govern established religions, so the critique goes, it's now being treated as establishing a kind of secularism that is in fact harming religious communities. And that would be something that Israel would have to avoid if it were to overlearn from the American example.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you know, think of it this way. The baker who doesn't want to bake a cake for a gay wedding and is told that therefore he loses his license to run a bakery is basically in a situation like a dissenter in a society with an established religion. He's being told to take part in a essentially religious rite that he does not believe is valid as the price of entry into the public sphere. That is what non-establishment was meant to preclude and to avoid. And part of what it says is that there's really no such thing as secularism. Ultimately, people have a religion. And if that religion looks like the morality of contemporary progressive liberalism, then it's going to operate like a religion one way or another. And you have to think about how to protect religious diversity and the capacity of people in religious communities to meet their obligations, that is, to do what they must do, has to be protected by the government they live under. Otherwise, it is an illegitimate government. I think this is really an insight at the core of the American tradition. This was James Madison's real innovation in religious liberty, is the notion that a society has to respect not only people's freedom to do what they want, but people's freedom to do what they must do. A pre-social, pre-political obligation is how he understood religious obligations. And that's why he made the case he did for non-establishment. Israel is in a different situation. And I do think that it has to think carefully about how not to create a set of frameworks that ultimately will be turned against religious believers. But it is a Jewish state. And it also, therefore, has to construct a framework for itself for functioning and operating as a Jewish state, some of whose Jewish population is Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox, and some is not. Again, I think that this is an area where Israel can certainly learn from the tradition both of toleration in the English-speaking world in general and of non-establishment in the United States in particular, but where it especially has to apply its own experience. Israel is a Jewish state, and it has been now for three quarters of a century. So that if you ask how can a Jewish state function, the answer is actually mostly to be found in Israel's experience.
I want to turn now to a subject that's very important for all this and where the American experience, it seems to me, does have a lot to offer. And that's the question of legitimacy. Let's say that there are some very smart people in Israel who get together and they have this convention and they read Yuval Levin and come out with some kind of settlement that they think is sensible. It is a very far step from that meeting of statesmen to an accepted and legitimate constitutional settlement. And I want to return our listeners to the American experience of the ratification debates and ask you to explain that. And I want to do that against this background. The background is that conservatism, thinking about just that political tradition, has always offered multiple meanings and understandings of itself. One understanding of conservatism is oriented around a set of policy ideas that limit the power of the government, and so in the American context have argued in favor of limited government and federalism and checks and balances and so on, and has tried to elevate the market economy as a way to decentralize knowledge and power further. That's one kind of conservatism, and it has always oriented itself around some specific policy proposals. A different kind of conservatism is attitudinal or temperamental, and has thought that it is necessary when making social changes to go slow, because it understands the human condition does not like radical change and will not accept radical change. And there are times when these two conservative orientations chime in harmony. and there are times in which they're in conflict. And I think that one way of understanding what's just happened in Israel with the judicial reforms is that these two conservatisms were seen as in tension with each other. In other words, that the reformers, Yariv Levin and Simcha Rothman and other people who are pushing for judicial reform, it is certainly understandable and defensible, it seems to me, to describe what they were doing as pursuing a conservative policy, in the sense that they were trying to decentralize power and make power more democratically legitimate. On the other hand, you could see what they were doing as, in a sense, messianic or revolutionary by moving too quickly, and therefore against that other kind of conservative tendency. Now, when America needed to make a big change, to get rid of the Articles of Confederation and institute something new, it had a very clear process for doing that. So I suppose I'd like to ask you two things. One, if there's something that Israel can learn from the manner in which it legitimated its constitution. But also, Yuval, I think with the perspective of history, it's easy to sort of forget and erroneously think that the American ratification debates were these serene and peaceful and intellectual affairs. That's not the case. If you're living through those moments, you wouldn't have thought that, and you wouldn't have felt that way. So we shouldn't be so afraid of the tensions and passions that arise in these moments. I think that that was part of the American experience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think these points are connected. I mean, I would say the question of legitimacy is really at the center of this, not only in the sense of how do you make a new political order viable and acceptable, but also of why you need it to begin with. The question of legitimacy is the question at the heart of the crisis that Israel is living through now, where on the one hand, you have the government saying the actions of the court are not legitimate. I think saying that quite rightly, frankly. And on the other hand, you have a lot of protesters and others saying the actions of the government are not legitimate because they're being taken in a way that's too hasty or under situations where people's motives are questionable or whatever it is. The great service that democratic institutions can provide to a free society is fundamentally a legitimating service. They enable us to treat uses of power as legitimate. Even when we are in the minority, when we lose the vote, we can see that what's happening here is a legitimate process. And the next time we might win the vote. The process by which that could happen is clearly there and is operating. And people have to have a sense that there are constraints on the way in which power is used, that there are boundaries, that there are processes. And that's really what we're talking about here, is how to establish a process that gives people that sense. And that means that the creation of that process itself has to be clearly legitimated by the means it takes. So a few things that really mattered in the American instance. First of all, that there was broad recognition that there was a need for change. And the convention that created the Constitution was called together more or less by the Congress that existed before it, and that its work was a process of negotiation. It was not a work of political theory. I think the American Constitution is coherent. It makes sense. It's rooted in some premises that we can grasp, but it's a negotiated product. And it deals with differences and different views by bargaining through them. And so by showing their partisans that they were heard and they were incorporated and they were listened to, so that the process is clearly a function of bargaining. I think that would have to happen in any constitutional process in Israel too. And finally, the product of it was essentially put to the public for its approval. In a series of state ratifying conventions, which were very open, the electorate that approved the American Constitution was by far the broadest electorate in the history of the world at that time. We now think of it as narrow because in most states, women could not participate in it. In all states, it was only open to white citizens. But if you compare it to what came before it, it was easily the most democratic process that the world had ever seen. And it was essentially a kind of state-by-state referendum. People could participate in these conventions. The document was put before them, and there were very raucous debates before the conventions and during them about whether this should be approved, about the pros and cons. We think of those debates now through the lens of the Federalist Papers, which are very high-level, almost academic-level political theory about these documents. But most of what happened in those debates was not the Federalist Papers. It was a lot of personal invective, a lot of attacks on people's motives. The opponents of the Constitution viewed it as an elitist move that was intended to disempower the public, that was not nearly democratic enough. And on the other side, also, there were a lot of people who made arguments about the dangers of democracy leading to demagogues. This was not a quiet conversation. And there's no way that it could be. It emerged out of a crisis, as inevitably it would, and it was fought out in a crisis atmosphere, as inevitably it would be. I think if Israel goes into this kind of process, it should expect much the same, but the process has to work hard to offer proof of its own legitimacy, to both enable the different factions of Israeli society to interact and negotiate with each other, and ultimately to put the result before the public. I think there's no alternative to that.
So there's a kind of faith in the procedures by which it arrives at ratification. Though we can understand that it would be debated in an atmosphere of crisis, it seems to me that attempting to do such a thing in 2023 offers some unique challenges not faced by America's framers, and I'm thinking mostly technological. As we're having this conversation in these days and weeks, there is a group of Israeli officials that are meeting, that are convened by President Herzog, and they are arguing about how to try to salvage some kind of reform compromise that satisfies the needs of protesters and the needs of the government. And one of the challenges that that group faces is that while they are in the room, at the very time that they are in the room, making various proposals, those proposals are leaked and then instantly known by their base and by their base's opponents. And it's very hard to think creatively and boldly with that kind of scrutiny. Wonder if there's a way to do the same kind of judo move where the American framers took a problem that they knew they could not do away with and instead brought it into the government as one of the sources of that government's stability. This, too, seems to me a problem that simply cannot be put back into its cage, and it will be with us and it will be with them as they try to work this out. I wonder if there's any way that you can think of that could be dealt with.
It's a very hard challenge. And, you know, in some ways they faced a similar kind of challenge, though not the instantaneous access by the public to their deliberations. But the American Constitutional Convention thought very hard about whether its deliberations should be open to the public and decided that they would not be. And the convention took place under strict rules of confidentiality to the point where the windows were sealed shut in the hall in the summer in Philadelphia. If you've been in Philadelphia in August, you know, just imagine it 150 years before air conditioning. And they decided that was essential. And they thought so from then on. I mean, Madison and Hamilton both in later years said, if it had been open to the public, there would not have been a constitution. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but they certainly had that view. And the members, in a sense, kind of swore to each other that they would not leak, and they did not. And so, you know, James Madison took careful notes that were made public many years later, but there was not a contemporaneous account of what was happening at the convention. I think the reason that was important is ultimately that this was a bargaining convention, and it's very hard to bargain in public. I don't know that there is a solution to that problem now. It's not possible to impose rules of confidentiality under the conditions we live in now, maybe under, you know, genuine existential crises. I mean, obviously, people in Israel know how not to leak national security information, but you can't just treat this like that. It's not the same thing. And I think they've got to find a way to live with the fact that they're going to need to bargain, to make deals and compromises, even though there will be all kinds of stories, some true and some not, about what they're doing all the time as they go. I don't know that I see a way around that. I think they just have to have the stomach to deal with it and be able to show their constituencies that they're bargaining on their behalf is probably about the best they can do.
The Solution to Israel's Crisis Might Be in America's Constitution was published in the New York Times on March 31st, 2023. Yuval Levin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, John.